Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Make sure not to miss a single podcast and subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite subscription service. The views expressed in this presentation are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Army, or Department of Defense.
Welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Ron Granieri, professor of history at the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College and podcast editor of the War Room. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Conversations about the relationship of the military to society often focus on formal civil-military relations. But anyone who has been in the military or worked close to a major installation knows there are myriad unofficial civ-mil relationships, including what can euphemistically be termed the commodification of companionship. In her recent talk to the Army War College, entitled Hidden in Plain Sight, Militarized Sexual Economies, Kara Dixon-Vuick, one of the leading scholars on men, women, and the military in the United States today, has considered how such connections emerge, how they are regulated, and what they tell us about the modern military and modern society. Kara Dixon-Vuick is the Lance Corporal Benjamin W. Schmidt Professor of War, Conflict, and Society in the 20th Century America at Texas Christian University. She is the author of The Girls Next Door, Bringing the Home Front to the Front Lines from Harvard University Press in 2019, and Officer, Nurse, Woman, the Army Nurse Corps in the Vietnam War from Johns Hopkins in 2010. She is the editor of the Rutledge Handbook on Gender War in the U.S. Military, co-editor of Managing Sex in the U.S. Military, and the co-editor of Cambridge University Press's book series, Military, War, and Society in Modern American History. Vuick serves on the Department of the Army Historical Advisory Subcommittee and the advisory board for the Vietnam Women's Memorial Foundation. She is, in all of her spare time, writing a new book called Drafting Women, and we are delighted that she's taken the time to meet with us today on A Better Peace. Welcome, Kara Dixon-Vuick.
Thanks, Ron.
It is delightful to have you here, Kara. And you have such an impressive array of publications on gender, the military, and society. I was just like reading out the titles. Do you see a logical progression in your choice of topics?
I'm not sure I would have seen a logical progression several years ago, but looking back on it now, I think I do. Mm-hmm. So I got interested in the stories of nurses in Vietnam as an undergrad. Mm-hmm. I was in my senior seminar class at Marshall University, and I was looking for a topic, and I was interested in the Vietnam War because I had an uncle who had served. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something on women's history. And so I initially thought, I'll write about women who had husbands or sons or boyfriends or whatever who served in the war, and then realized that there were source problems with that. And I found Linda Vandevanter's Home Before Morning, which is the first autobiography of a nurse. And mm-hmm. I read it on a Friday night because I was a nerd. And I was hooked. I read it start to finish, and that was it. I was in the deep end, and I found these women who went to Vietnam. And so that became my dissertation as a grad student, and mm-hmm. then my first book. And as it evolved, I was interested in these women because mm-hmm. I found their stories really compelling. And I was interested in this tension in their experiences between, we're here as professionals and we're here to do what we think is really important work, but also we're facing all of these other expectations, whether they come from on high or from men in the military who sort of look to them as mother figures or sister figures or also, objects of desire. And it could be all over the map. And so I was interested in that tension. Here you have really professional, trained nurses who outrank the majority of the men they are treating.
Right.
And yet you've got William Westmoreland still saying, I want nurses to be pretty and have their hair fixed and wear lipstick and do all these things. Never mind that we're in a war, right?
Right.
And so when I was working on that book, I kept thinking, what was it like for these women to experience these sort of dual expectations? Mm-hmm. And I knew when I was working on that book that there were these other women with the Red Cross who were there to entertain soldiers, right? To do sort of the morale work, like serve coffee, serve donuts, this kind of thing. And I knew about these women, and so I thought, if nurses, with their rank and their professional training and all of this, if they are facing these expectations to be, to represent all of these things to soldiers, what must it be like for women whose explicit job is to boost morale?
Right.
What is it like for them? They don't have rank on their shoulders to, you know, to say, I've had enough, like, go away. Right. They can't do that. Their whole job is to entertain. And so that's how the second book came into being, was looking, starting in the Vietnam era, but thinking, what's the origin of all these programs? And so I started in World War I and then went through Afghanistan. And along the way, sort of ran across different experiences that I thought were interesting in terms of, you know, we're creating these morale programs to keep soldiers away from something. And what is this thing we're trying to keep them away from? But also running into interesting stories about how the military is managing things like reproduction and birth control and interesting stories there. So I guess it led to the talk I gave today on sex work through an unexpected means or unexpected route.
Right. You know, it's my grandmother was an Army nurse and joined the Army after a failed marriage and basically found purpose there and ended up becoming, like, in retirement, she became president of various American Legion posts. And I never had a chance to ask her what it was like to actually be an Army nurse, which would have been, I don't know if she served overseas, but she would have started during the Second World War.
Wow.
Yeah. But I think about this question, right, is that when a woman decides, you know, becoming a nurse already, right, is, you know, for her generation was a big step because it was a responsible job that was taking her away from home. Mm-hmm. But then to join, when a woman decides to become a nurse and an Army nurse, all these questions come to mind. And one of them is basically, at what point did the Army decide that nurses would be officers? And was this intentional in order to protect the nurses against the enlisted men they would be nursing?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I wondered if it was that simple. Right?
That is the intention. The getting actual rank that comes with actual responsibility and equal pay and privileges and all of those things takes some time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But even in World War I, when nurses are serving overseas, they're wearing rank and they call it relative rank.
Oh, okay.
And so it allowed the Army to segregate them, you know, with other officers, even though they're not treating them equally to other officers. But that's the intention, right? We have to keep these nurses away from the patients that they're treating in social settings.
Interesting. That question occurred to me just as I was listening to you today and as you were doing your talk just now.
Yeah. And obviously for the nurses, that's not necessarily the rationale, right? They want the privilege and they want the equal nature of being officers. But from the military's perspective, it's different. And as nurses are serving in wars where they are closer in age sometimes to the patients, they resent that segregation.
Really?
Right. And so in some ways it protects. And in other ways, they're like, well, why can't I hang out with, you know, private whoever?
Right.
He's the same age as my brother, or he's the same age of guys I went to school with. And so it kind of works both ways.
Interesting. See, that's, once again, none of these questions is simple. So of course, as Clausewitz said, and I'm required, of course, to reference Clausewitz on every episode, but as Clausewitz said, right, in war, everything is simple, but the simplest thing is difficult. And that is both simple and difficult. How do you see your work fitting in with the larger scholarship on not just military and society, but especially women, the military and society, or gender, the military and society, how you would choose to define it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because for a long time, some of the early works on women were strictly on women, like recovering these women's experiences. Let's, you know, look for women who we know did these things but haven't been written about. And I think my work is partly that, right? Talking about these women who had experiences that not everybody knows about or that might not be understood, especially in the case of women who are entertainers, might not be understood very well. But also to put that in a broader framework of gender, in that what did it mean for these women to do this work, and why did they need to be women mm-hmm. to do this work? You know, it's even with nurses, right? That until the Vietnam War era, nurses are women.
Right. Right?
The Army had let men be nurses in the reserves only in the mid-50s. Not until mid-60s are they allowed to be in the regular Army. And so it's a question of, for me, these women in particular, but also questions of gender. And mm-hmm. Why did the Army require them to be women? What was it about being women that was essential to that work? Mm-hmm. And so I think for my work overall, I spent a lot of time asking what it meant for women to serve.
Okay.
What did that service mean? What did it mean for the women? What did it mean for the institution? And now with the current project I'm working on about women in selective service and conscription, it's basically the flip of that. Mm-hmm. Why has the United States never required the service of women? What has it meant to exclude or never to have required that? Mm-hmm. And so I guess overall it's about what does it mean for these particular people to serve, whether it's as nurses or service through civilian organizations or whatever.
But. See, and not only have we not required women's service, but the threat of somehow requiring women's services has actually been used as an argument against the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah.
Right. If we pass this,
right.
They're going to draft your daughter.
Right.
And that still hovers over this. Although now we have the flip side of that is now some people are saying, well, if women want to be equal, then why don't they sign up for selective service
right.
too?
Which was the argument for the Equal Rights Amendment. Initially, that mm-hmm. was the proponents of the Equal Rights Amendment were saying equal obligations and are the counterpart to equal rights,
right?
They saw the two as absolutely essential and connected. But it changes depending on who's using that argument, right?
It certainly does. I always think about with say, the current selective service mm-hmm. system, mm-hmm. right? So I basically have been reminded of my selective service obligation twice, right? One when I signed up in 1985 when I was 18, mm-hmm. and the other one when I applied for this job at the War College where I had to go and find my selective service registration number.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it is this ghostly presence, right? And yet it is that we still resist including women in it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's killed a couple, debates recently in the NDAA that mm-hmm. that has been a sticking point up until the 11th hour that the NDAA wasn't going to pass until this issue was dealt with. And it's every time it's been sort of kicked aside in a political football exchange for something. So we're still... We've been debating it very recently, but we're still not there yet.
Not there yet. Interesting. How do military audiences respond to your talks? I don't know how many before you came here to the War College. We had a very nice exchange about your discussion today about militarized sexual economies. How have military audiences responded to your work, and do you see that as any different from scholarly responses to your work?
Yeah, I think military audiences are interested in the people,
mm-hmm.
Sort of by and large. Mm-hmm. They're interested in the people's experiences. And what I found is even if the room is typically a room full of male soldiers, of an older age, they might be Vietnam vets or whatever, they will appreciate hearing about nurses in mm-hmm. particular or donut dollies or whoever, because they recognize what those women did in terms of whether it's physical care or more, morale boosting work, whatever it is, they recognize that those people did important work. And they typically will see that work hasn't been credited or recognized to the extent that they think it should be.
Right.
At the same time, when I have talked about things like sexual harassment, in every military setting, there will be one person, and sometimes it's a man and sometimes it's a woman, who will stand up and say, in the man's case, I treated every woman with the utmost respect. Or in the woman's case, to say, I was treated with the utmost respect.
Right.
And it's interesting to me that in those situations, they feel they have to defend an entire institution. And I'm like, from my perspective, I'm like, great. I'm glad that was your experience.
Right,
but in a massive institution with millions of people in uniform, you know, what I find in the historical record might not be your personal experience. And and so that it's interesting to me that the way that discussion will be heard as an attack on an institution at large, when I try to be very careful to say this is, you know, certain people and not to, you know, paint with a wide brush.
Right.
But it is interesting that that will happen.
Yeah. I mean, because in both ways, it's kind of a personalization of the story, right? Mm-hmm. It's like I respect these people, and so I like to hear their story. But when I start hearing about the institution, I want to come back and say, you know, that's not me.
Right. Right. And they see it as a negative, like that I am somehow making this attack on the institution. And again, I'm the historian sort of writing about or talking about what I find in the record or what other people have spoken about.
Right.
And so it's an interesting defense, right, you know, coming from those folks.
For sure. Well, and this issue of, you know, the military as an institution versus the lives of individual service members, that gets me into a question of when you do your research, right, what kind of sources do you find most useful? Are you able to get at the individual experience, say, of enlisted people, or, you know, how close can you get to the lives of these people that you study?
Yeah. I started out with oral histories.
Oral histories, nurses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I really love that part. You know, I could go to reunions of nurses, or, you know, I went to one of the first times I met nurses of the Vietnam War were at the 10th anniversary of the Vietnam Women's Memorial in 2003.
Right.
And I went and I met all of these amazing women, and I got to sit down and do interviews and then followed up with people later. And so while I was sort of looking at official Army Nurse Corps records in Falls Church, Virginia, at the time, they were in a very weird shopping mall at the time, I would go through these documents and read policy or read, you know, things from the chief nurse perspective. And then I would go and talk to these women who were at this hospital. And it was a lot of fun to interview, especially a bunch of women who were at the same hospital at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would start to hear the same story from different perspectives, where they would tell stories about each other. You know, sometimes, oh, you didn't, you know, remember when so-and-so did this, or that good time we had here, or this horrible thing that happened. But it was those sorts of interviews, like, always made it real for me. I love putting the two together, you know, to seeing the institutional history and sort of the intent of the institution, but also to see how that gets lived out by actual people. Does it, you know, does the policy or does the intent actually have an effect on how people experience a war or experience their service? And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And I think it's interesting to see where those two kinds of things push against the institutional history. And so in earlier eras, right, when I did the second book, you know, I can't go interview women from World War One.
Right, right.
And I had to read, and had to read, like it was a chore.
This is the person who read a whole book on nurses on a Friday night while she was
right,
in college,
yeah. Right? Yeah. Exactly, yeah. But to read women's accounts from World War One about their work in France with doughboys, you know, and that was as close as I could get. What is also really interesting in people's accounts and women's accounts is what you tell certain audiences changes. You might tell the same story differently to your coworker than you do to your child or your mother. And so the best sources I ever found were I had letters home of a woman who was with the Red Cross in World War II, had letters that she had written to her friend, and then also letters she had written to her parents. And she describes one situation where the women are put on a boat and they're to serve, you know, tea and crumpets to the senior officers and have a nice little evening boat cruise, which is a bizarre thing that is happening in the middle of World War II in and of itself.
For sure.
But the story she tells her parents about what happened that evening is very sanitized and very upstanding. You know, it's very professional, and we serve donuts. We had a very lovely conversation. And then what she tells her friend at home is that the captain on the ship was pretty handsy. Right. And so she's telling different stories to different audiences. And that helps, I think, to illustrate or, I don't know, point to the ways that even that oral histories or things like oral histories or letters or memoirs are still crafted for particular audiences. And as historians, we still have to keep that in mind.
Right. Well, and but it is, it's a real blessing when you, the same person is recounting the same two things.
Yeah,
it's
that was a goal of mine.
It's like, you love it when you find somebody keeps a diary. You love it when somebody who writes is a good letter writer.
Right. Yeah.
How do you feel about the way that, when I think about the topics you describe in your two books, it's funny, is that my first thought, and this is, maybe this shows my age, I'm not sure what, but I think of the television program China Beach.
Oh, yeah.
Which includes a nurse, an entertainer, and a professional woman.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about, I mean, I'm asking how you feel about that show, but also just how do you feel about the way that popular culture has represented women in the military or in these militarized environments?
Yeah, it's almost like they're archetypes,
right?
I mean, even in the China Beach example, I mean, the donut dolly has to be so naive, and her, you know, her name is Cherry, and she's just, I mean, it's like you can't make this up.
I didn't even think about that until just now.
it's every stereotype, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, China Beach, I think, did a fair job with the nurse, right? And showing the complexities of that experience and also what it cost her emotionally.
Right.
I think overall, women in war are still typecast, right? Nurses, we kind of understand their role. But even then, they're still, you know, romantic characters in movies, or they still play that kind of role.
Right.
I don't think we really have seen on film or in a TV series or something like that the real nuances or complexities of women's experiences in the ways that, for all of its, you know, historical faults or whatever, something like Band of Brothers did for average enlisted guys in World War II, right? We see all different kinds of people and different kinds of experiences and motivations. And I think still when we see women, you know, they're like Florence Nightingale type figures in a more modern frame, or they're there for ulterior motives.
Or they're just there to be emotionally tormented by their experience, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because I think about that, right? I can think of one film that deals with modern women in combat situations, right? And that's what In the Line of Fire.
Courage Under Fire.
Yeah. With Meg Ryan, right?
Yep.
And you know, so there is an effort to do that, but of course, she is literally the only woman in that movie.
Yeah.
And so the emphasis is how difficult it is to be a woman when you're the only woman.
Uh-huh.
But the experience of women in the military is different now when there is more. You know, there's not a lot, but there's still more than one in many environments. And so I think about that is how have you had much in your ongoing research, right? If you've done or read oral histories of veterans, right? Have you studied much in the oral histories of women right now or during the last 20 years of the global war on terror? Have you had enough exposure to those sources to see whether their experiences are materially different than the older ones?
Yeah. I mean, you're sort of asking is the character or the nature of war changed, right?
Ooh, look at that. That would be a second Clausewitz reference in this discussion. Thank you very much, Dr.
Bonus Vick. Parts right there.
Hold on. Let me write that down. Okay.
A gold star today or something. I mean, I think in some ways the experience is radically different, right? I mean, from the very basic entry and what women are permitted to do in today's military is radically different. The rank structure, pay, promotion, right? In all of the sort of marked ways, it is absolutely different than it was pre and, you know, volunteer force, for example.
Right.
Pre-1978, in the case of the Army with the dissolution of the WAC. It is fundamentally different. And yet, there are legacies of women are the minority. Do they belong here? What are they doing here? That I think still in many ways shape women's experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is military culture. And I think part of it is broader society and culture. And it's a really tangled web, and it's not easily detangled, and it's not easy to separate those threads. But I think it is fundamentally different and yet still remnants of that. I mean, so if you look at, for example, the FETs or the Lioness program in Iraq and Afghanistan, women's presence in these teams is justified because their sex is required, because we have to have women, in particular, women's bodies to converse, to search, to do whatever with local populations. We have to have women.
Right.
And yet they're saying at the same time, your sex is irrelevant, right? We all bleed green, or we all wear olive drab in the old frame, right? Like, it's a really strange mix of sex doesn't matter and sex is absolutely essential. Hmm. And I think that sort of combination of rationales must be really strange to experience. Right.
Yes, I encourage anyone listening to this program to send in their comments on that particular question, because I think about that, right, is that the military is becoming more diverse, society is becoming more aware of the need for sensitivity to diversity, and the idea that the military is both a reflection of the society that it defends, and also a product of that society, and so how they. You know, how the rules develop, how the attitudes develop, right? Nothing happens overnight, but the Army or the military in general is different today than it was.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But that doesn't mean that people have stopped thinking about women in particular ways.
Right, right. Or anybody else.
Or anybody else, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, you know, when we define what is masculine, what is feminine, Well, and then... So as we move along, unfortunately, I see the sands of the hourglass are going along here. But to get back to the specific topic today for your talk was about the sexual economy and the militarized sexual economy. How should we understand the relationship between the military and the shadow economy more broadly? We think about soldiers, or service members who are, you know, especially when they're serving overseas, they're in this sort of in a wartime situation. They're in this different space where things are allowed that would not be allowed in normal life. Mm-hmm. And how does that relate to this sort of shadow economy? And then how is that different when they're back home and they're still serving in the military, but that shadow economy is still around them?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, that's a great sort of juxtaposition as well that, you know, what I said today is that I think a lot of people, when they think about, you know, shadow economies in particular that revolve around sex work, they think of it as just, you know, they resort to tropes again. It's the world's oldest profession, and they think of it as just being this natural thing that happens. And as a historian, what I would say is that it happens because of choices that individuals have made. Mm-hmm. Those choices are hard and they're difficult, but they reflect the moment in which that person lives. They reflect their cultural norms. They reflect... the attitudes of the time about things like morality and public health. They reflect medicine, right? They reflect what medical doctors can do with things like venereal disease. How easily is it cured or not? And they're absolutely always wrapped up in race. And so it matters where the situation is occurring. So, for example, World War II, the U.S. military says absolutely not to regulating prostitution in a place like France, but has no problem doing so in Northern Africa or Hawaii or New Caledonia. And so they're making decisions based on what we think of people, right? What we think of the men, and it's always men, what we think of the men we're trying to satiate or ward away from one thing and direct to another. We're trying to avert a diplomatic crisis that they think is inevitable if men don't have their needs met. But it's also about what they think of local populations and what women they deem acceptable to do sex work and not other women, right? Mm-hmm. Some women are seen as buffers and protection for against other women. And so there are decisions being made that affect people, but they also reflect a set of cultural values that change over time.
Right.
Right. And so it's creating economies in one way or the other, right? Yeah. Whatever decision is made, it's creating either a regulated, legitimate economy, or it's creating a black market economy, or it's creating anything. it's going to create an economy of some sort. Right. And so there are choices being made in terms of how that's regulated and who regulates it and how it's managed. And yeah, very tangled webs and complicated.
Right. And literally these are questions that local commands have to decide. What are we going to say is out of bounds? What are we going to say is off limits?
Right.
And how are we going to police that?
Yeah. Yeah. None of which are easy.
None of which are easy.
None of which are easy and none of which are without consequence, I think. And that was, you know, I was writing this chapter that the talk came from, and I came to this realization at the end that, I mean, essentially it's a damned if you're doing, damned if you don't situation, mm-hmm. in that regardless of what decisions are made, there are going to be consequences. And mm-hmm. all of it is very complicated and affects some people more than others. But it, as we know now, also create sort of worldwide economies that are connected and immigration networks and human trafficking and all sorts of really ugly, horrible things that have come out of this system that has developed over the last several decades.
Right. So. And it's probably not going to go away.
Yeah.
So
probably not.
It will be there to be, it'll be there to be analyzed and to be understood. And hopefully, Kara, we'll have you to explain these things to us again, right? we're about out of time for today, but I just thank you, Kara Dixon Viewick, for coming to us to talk about your work on A Better Peace and about these important questions for anybody who wants to understand the military and modern society.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to be in the new Root Hall.
See, there you go. It's we spare no expense for our guests from Texas. So thanks to Kara Dixon Viewick for joining us today, and thanks to all of you for listening in. Please send us your comments on this program and all the programs. Send us your suggestions for future programs. We're always interested in hearing from you. Please take a moment to subscribe to A Better Peace. After you've subscribed to Better Peace, of course, please then rate and review this podcast so that other people can find out about it, because that's how we continue to grow this community for conversations like this one. And so while this conversation is over, we look forward to welcoming you to the next one. And so until next time, from the War Room, I'm Ron Granary.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.